Very excited this week to have as our colloquium speaker, Edward Farhi. Professor Farhi is now at Google. Before that, he had a long distinguished career at MIT, where he's now the Cecil and Ida Green Professor of Physics Emeritus. 2004 to 2016, he was the director of the MIT Center for Theoretical Physics and has won many awards. He's done many interesting things, very broad person. He had a long career as a particle physicist and cosmologist before embarking on a career in quantum information and quantum computing in recent decades. But before that, he was famous for things like two great papers on whether you could create a baby universe in the lab, famous papers on strange matter, many other topics. One showing that the Gott time machine was impossible to create in reality. Lots of very interesting stuff. But anyway, in the past 2 decades or so, he's been primarily focusing on quantum computation and has made many famous contributions to that field, including the quantum approximate optimization algorithm, which 2014, and which has been subject of much excitement and interest ever since, and so we're very happy to have him here to tell us about that today.
Okay, can you hear me okay in the back? It's good?
Thank you.
Okay, so, well, okay, I can stand anywhere. You can hear me, but I have to come here to advance the slides. Okay, so, like it was stated, I work for Google. I work for their quantum information effort, but I spent many years as a professor at MIT working on quantum information before I went to Google. I've been working there for 5 years officially, or 4.5 years. But my interest has been pretty only focused on the development of quantum algorithms, because I think we need to have a reason to build quantum computers. I think quantum algorithm might be a good reason. And I also think that there are really interesting math problems associated with quantum algorithms. And so I'm going to focus today on one particular algorithm, the quantum approximate optimization algorithm, and then I'm going to try to talk about some recent work in this area. So let's begin. Okay, so what I'm interested in is optimization. So the generic optimization problem is you have bits, n bits, and then on the n bits, there's a function which you want to maximize. But the function is, in the context that we care about, is usually written as a sum of m terms. And each term is called a clause. And a clause, C alpha, will look at a bit string and look at a subset of the bits, like the first two, and it'll have some condition on those first two bits that says whether the clause is satisfied or not. So for example, a very common thing to satisfy the clause is to have the bits disagree. So you have 4 settings of the bits, 2 satisfy the clause, 2 do not. Okay, so the problem then becomes you have a sum over clauses, and you wish to find the maximum over all strings of that clause function. And this problem, to find the actual maximum, is considered in computer science to be intractable, because the only way you could really be sure to find the maximum is to go through all 2 to the n possible inputs. And it is generally believed that there's no efficient algorithm that will find the maximum with less than searching over 2 to the n inputs. And But there's another thing you might wish to do, which is not to look for the best solution, but look for a good solution. So you want to output a string z such that c of z over the actual maximum is big. Not necessarily one, but as big as you can get it. And this ratio of c of z over c max is called the approximation ratio of the string. So your algorithm wants to put output a string that does a good job. It's not a big audience, so if there are any questions, just stop, okay, and ask me. So we're going to try this with a quantum algorithm, and I am assuming in this audience that people have some idea of what the basics of a quantum algorithm are. So the way we're going to do this is we're going to have two operators, one I call uc of gamma, and it's the exponential of the cost function. Now the cost function, oh, I should have written this one slide. I'm so sorry. See, the cost function in this quantum world, there's a Hilbert space, and a basis for it are the 2 to the n vectors labeled by the bit strings. And so the cost function acting on one of those gives the value of the cost function times that vector. So the cost function is diagonal in the computational basis. But this cost function, so it's a diagonal operator in the computational basis, and I'm going to talk about the unitary e to the minus I gamma c, because the cost function is a sum of commuting terms, can also be written as the product over the clauses of e to the minus I gamma c alpha. Now, the other operator I'm going to introduce is b, which is the sum of the sigma x's, and sometimes we write xj. In computer science language, we usually write xj, which really means sigma j on the x. So it's the x Pauli. And then the next operator I'm going to introduce is the exponential of b with the parameter beta. And that operator, in physics term, rotates the spins around the x direction. And then we're going to start in a state s, which is the uniform superposition of all possible input strings, because an algorithm has different ingredients. It has the operators, and it has the thing place where you start. So we're going to start in the uniform superposition, which is actually an easy state to make, because it's actually all the spins lined up in the x direction. By x direction, I mean, if you think of the plus state, which I wrote there as 1 over root 2, 0, plus 1, that's an eigenstate of sigma x, where the spin is in the x direction. But note that that's a sum of 0 and 1. So this state, the uniform superposition, is actually a product state over all the spins lined up in the x direction, an easy state to make. Now, what we're going to now do is introduce an algorithm. So for any p, what we're going to do, p is a parameter which characterizes the algorithm. I'm going to introduce two p parameters, a bunch of gammas and a bunch of betas. And then I'm going to make a quantum state, which I call gamma beta, which is just the operation alternately of these two different operators on the initial state with parameters at each level. So we first operate with the cost function operator with parameter gamma 1, then the rotation operator with parameter beta 1, and then we go down the line until we've done this 2p applications. And the circuit depth here is really not bad, but let's not get into that. And anyway, now what we want to do is look at this object, which is the expected value of the cost function in the state gamma beta. So the idea of the algorithm is this. We're going to try to arrange the parameters so the expected value of the cost function is big. And that's the goal. Find parameters that make the expected value of the cost function big. And if the expected value of the cost function is big, and then you make a measurement of the state, you're going to find a string which has a good value of the cost function. That's the idea. So let me define MP as the maximum of gamma and beta, of FP gamma and beta. In other words, there is a maximum. I'm not saying I know what it is. But you'll note that as I increase the depth, the maximum can only get bigger. Because if I look at it at level p minus 1, that's the same as at level p with the last two parameters set to 0. So if I relax that the last two parameters are set to 0, I can only make it better. So the algorithm can only improve with depth if you can find the maximum. And actually, we can prove that in the limit as p goes to infinity, the maximum is actually the max of the function. But that's not too relevant here, because it may require p to be doubly exponential in n, the size. And I'm not really interested in that limit, but it's a fact that there are parameters, if p is infinite, that will achieve the actual maximum. But of course, I don't know how to find those, and I don't know how to run the algorithm an infinite number of steps. So one way to approach this algorithm is to do what's called angle search. By that, what we're going to do is we're going to have a quantum computer, and you start with some angles, gamma and beta, and you use the quantum computer to make the state gamma beta, and then what you do is you measure a string, z, and out you get the expected value, the cost function, excuse me, with that string. Now, then you might change the parameters and do it again, and keep changing the parameters, doing it again, attempting to go uphill by using an outer loop optimizer. So you're using the quantum computer to call the function to evaluate the quantum state, but you have an outer loop optimizer, which is bringing the cost function up. Now, I don't know how that would work, but the idea would you repeat with new angles are trying to get near the maximum. And people often talk about variational quantum algorithms, and that's generally what they mean. Algorithms, quantum algorithms, where you have parameters, you don't know how to set them, you run a quantum computer, you measure, you change, you run a quantum algorithm, you measure, you change the parameters, attempting to go to some objective, maybe the ground state of a Hamiltonian, or from, in my case, the maximum of a cost function. So that's the general strategy for what are called variational quantum algorithms. But it turns out that if you fix the depth, we can actually classically pre-process and determine the best angles in advance. Now let me show you why that is. Let's look at an example called max cut. Max cut is a problem where I have a graph, and the goal, the computational task, is to assign to each vertex, let's say a 1 or a minus 1, with the goal of making the number of disagreements as big as possible. So what you're doing is you're putting 1s and minus 1s on your graph, and you want to maximize the sum over the edges of the places where they disagree. And then you could think of that as a cutting the graph into two pieces. And that's why they call it a cut. But let's just think of it computationally. And so for the max cut, the cost function is the sum over the edges of the graph. And look at the form of the edge function. It's 1 half minus zj zk plus 1. The reason you can see that is if the two z's are equal, then you get minus 1 plus 1, which is 0. So that's bad. But if the two z's are opposite, you get minus minus 1 plus 1 over 2, which is 1. So when the bits disagree, the clause is 1, and that is just a happy clause. So let's look at p equals 1. Look at the contribution from edge jk. So remember, I have that state. The state I told you is a product state over bits lined up in the x direction. And that's the object I wish to calculate. Okay. So first of all, the thing in the middle was e to the I beta b, z, j, z, k, e to the minus I beta b. But that's actually just a rotation of the two spin operators. And so that just rotates the spins in the I called them spin operators, z operators. But you know, spin and z are the same thing, up to a half. So that's just a little elementary quantum mechanics to see that the rotation of zj, zk is a rotation of zj by angle beta and a rotation of zk by angle beta, giving rise to that operator. And notice that I haven't changed, I'm still only looking at bits j and k, because I've rotated them, but I haven't introduced other bits. But now what I'm going to do is I'm going to conjugate, meaning in the operator sense, by Let's go back to see why. You see, there's a conjugation of the middle operator by e to the I gamma c. But you see, if you think about it, if there are bits in the in C that have nothing to do with J or K, those terms commute through. So the only thing I care about when I conjugate here are bits on the qubits on the graph which are connected to J and K. I don't care about any others. So that means I can just look at J and K, and I have to then look at the neighborhood of it. And the name, I've told you I'm only looking at a three-regular graph. A three-regular graph means every vertex has three friends. So there are really only three possible ways the graph can look. If you look at the one on the right, J and K each are connected to other bits which are not themselves the same as each other. But in the middle graph, J is connected to somebody, and J is connected to someone else. K is connected to somebody, but he's also connected to the same guy as J. And in the case all the way to the left, both J and K are connected to bits which are the same on both sides. So there are only three possible graphs. But you see, these three graphs involve respectively 4, 5, and 6 qubits only. So I can evaluate these on a classical computer. You know, the point here, of course, is that I don't know why it's doing that, making it blue. I can't stop being blue. It wants to be blue. I don't know why. Oh, there it went away. Anyway, you know, the point is that you can't typically evaluate an n qubit thing on a classical computer because your storage is 2 to the n. You know, you can't simulate a 100-qubit quantum computer because you can't put it on your laptop, but you can put a 6-qubit thing on your laptop. So if I just go through the graph and I count the number of edges which have which look like trees, which have one triangle or two triangles, I can evaluate the expected value of the cost function for this particular graph. So that means that I can actually, on a classical computer, determine the optimal angles for the lowest depth QAOA. I'm going to be able to do this at higher depth as well, but in this case. And then we were able to show in our first paper that at p equals 1, the lowest depth, the QAOA, will always produce a cut that is at least 0.6924 times the optimal cut. And the achievement here is that we were able to analyze the performance of a quantum algorithm on all instances, no matter how big. And we can tell you how to find the optimal parameters, and we can promise you that the cut value you're going to get, the approximation ratio is 0.6924. Now, you know, 30 years ago, the best provable algorithm for max cut was guess a random string, which produces an approximation ratio of 0.5. But then there's the famous Gomans-Williamson algorithm, which beats this. So we are not beating the best classical algorithm, but we are establishing the fact that we can prove something about a quantum algorithm in all cases. So now I want to change to another problem because there's a little story here. This problem is called E3-Lin2, max E3-Lin2. And this is a different problem. Here I have n variables and m equations, each with 3 variables. So this is the problem. I specify it by giving you triples. I say these 3 bits are in an equation, and I have to tell you whether when I add them up, mod 2, I get a 1 or a 0. So I give you an instance of a problem is a specification. It has a set of triples, and I tell you whether each set of triples should add to 1 or 0. And the task is to find an assignment that maximizes the number of satisfied equations. Now, this is a very strange problem because if I ask you, can you satisfy all the equations, you can answer that very quickly by doing Gaussian elimination, by doing linear algebra. So you can actually figure out whether this problem has a satisfying assignment. So I'm not interested in that case. I'm interested in the case when it has too many equations. They can't all be solved, and I want to maximize the number to find the optimal. This thing is called NP-hard, which means it's very hard to find the optimal solution. But we don't want the optimal solution, we want a good one. But still, how hard is this problem? Well, this is some interesting thing. There is an algorithm for this problem, which is guess a random string. If you guess a random string, you're going to satisfy half the equations. And you can sort of see that. You just, every equation has a 50-50 chance of being satisfied. So you're going to, that gives a provable result. But remarkably, if you have an algorithm that will, in worst case, give a half plus epsilon for any epsilon, if you had that, that would imply P equals NP. That means that, like, the whole edifice of computer science would collapse. If you could get the slightest improvement on a half. So now, that seems kind of hopeless, but there is a way you can help the algorithm seeker, and that's to say every variable is in no more than D equations. Now I've told you something. See, again, let me just be clear about something. I'm talking about worst case. When your algorithm has to work every single time, you have to prove to me it will always work. So now I'm giving you a little information. I'm telling you that every equation is no more than D equations. Well, that helps you a little bit. So in 2000, there was an algorithm introduced by a guy named Hostad that got a half plus constant over D. So in other words, that doesn't contradict the other thing, if you think about it, because if you make D big, it gets below any epsilon. So for bounded occurrence, E3-Lin2, there was an algorithm that got a half plus constant over D, but then our quantum algorithm got a half plus constant over D to the 3/4. Okay? So we then beat the best classical algorithm for a difficult problem because our dependence on D was better. So this was kind of a big deal. And what happened was that Scott Aronson blogged about it. And the computer scientists all got worked up. And they came up with a classical algorithm, got a half plus constant over D to the 1/2, which beat us. But I will say in our defense that group of computer scientists, it took 11 of them, only three of us. And that is a list of some of the top computer scientists in the world who ganged up on us. It was very sad. But anyway, they beat us. But what's the part of the lesson here is that we stimulated some interesting work. And if we then look at this, we actually improved our analysis. Oh, and I should have said that this algorithm was introduced by me, Jeffrey Goldstone, and Sam Gutman. And if you ever heard of Goldstone bosons, that's the same guy. Jeffrey Goldstone. Anyway, we improved our analysis, and we got 1 over 101 d to the 1/2 log d, which still isn't as good as theirs because we have that damn log there. But anyway, and in a typical case, we get another answer. Anyway, we're still off by a log. Maybe if we go to higher depth, we'll beat it. Maybe we already beat it, but we can't show it. There are a lot of interesting questions here. But anyway, my point here is that I think it's quite good if you have the ability to analyze a quantum algorithm, its performance, even in worst case, because it just, you know, it's what we want to be able to do, is to analyze it. Now, of course, some people say if you don't beat the best classical algorithm, who cares? What? Including all possible instances of the problem. In other words, in this case, I mean for every single size, all possible specification of the triples and whether they add to 0 and 1 at every size. So my algorithm has to work. If I told you I have 20 billion triples and, you know, I have 10 billion variables, 20 billion clauses, and your algorithm must work. That's what worst case means. It means every single time. It can never fail. Okay. Now, there is another thing which we talk about, typical case, but I don't want to talk about that now. That's when you look at random instances drawn from an ensemble. And then that can have different behavior characteristics. But we're, when people talk about NP complete or NP hard, they're always talking about worst case. They're typically not interested in typical. Very rarely do they care about typical. Okay, but anyway, let's keep going. Oh, so now I want to tell you another thing that's kind of interesting about the QAOA. Let's look at typical performance. Now I'm going to talk about random graphs with some distribution. Like, let's say we look at three regular graphs, and we include each edge included with probability 3 over n minus 1. So this is max cut. I want to look at max cut. But now, instead of looking at worst case, I'm going to toss three regular graphs. And that three regular graphs means every vertex has exactly 3. But I could also just include each edge with probability 3 over n minus 1. The average is then valence, or the average degree is 3, or I could do it with different, whatever. But now I'm not talking about worst case, which I just said computer scientists don't care about, but typical, because I want to. Okay? So now what we found sort of interesting is that we demonstrate that if we fix parameters gamma and beta for typical instances, and then you look at the expected value of the cost function for fixed gamma and beta at any depth, we find that it's the same for all instances. So now it's kind of interesting. I give you a random graph. I run the QAOA with certain parameters. I look at the expected value of the cost function. And now I give you another graph, you get the same thing. And this is work I did with these collaborators. Now, you know, let me prove why that's the case at the shallowest depth, p equals 1. I can actually prove it here. Because we just went through p equals 1 on max cut, and we saw that there are only three subgraph types that matter, which are the 6-qubit one, the 5, and the 3, and the 4. But if you have a random graph, okay, the fraction of each of those types is the same if the graph is big. In fact, you're going to have almost no triangles. You're going to have almost only trees. So that means that the only thing that matters in terms of analyzing the performance of the algorithm is the fraction of each subtype, because I already told you that's all you need. But those fractions concentrate on random graphs. So for random graphs at p equals 1, this whole thing is instance independent, which is sort of now clear. But now let me show you how strongly this holds. You see, it's not just we did a little numerical test. We looked at 20 vertex, 3 regular graphs, took 25 samples. And here we're running max cut on a classical computer on a laptop, but you can simulate a 20-qubit quantum computer. You have trouble simulating a 30-qubit quantum computer and a lot of trouble simulating a 40 or a 50-qubit quantum computer. But there's no trouble simulating a 20-qubit quantum computer on a laptop. So anyway, we could select the parameters at different depth so that I got a low value of the cost function. I could choose the parameters just so it gives a low value. But then you'll notice that with the parameters chosen for a low value, when we tossed 25 samples, the mean was, let's say, at p of 4 is 3.933. And yet, the standard deviation is very small. So numerically, we see this really works, even at high depth. Oh, and then just, and then, but a rand, you see, if you have a 20 vertex, 3 regular graph, it has 30 edges. So the average cut is 15. Because if you have a 30-edge graph and you throw down a random string, you'll satisfy half the edges. So the 15 is in the middle column. And we find that if we choose we random parameters, we get 15 with small standard deviation. On the other hand, we change the parameters to get a good value of the cut, which is above, way above 15. You'll notice here that, you know, at p of 7, you know, we're getting a good cut because the cut value, it's probably 27 or 26, the maximum cut, because this graph has 30 edges and so probably has a cut of 26 or 27, and the QAOA is doing a very good job, but the same parameters work on every instance. And that means that if you're running the QAOA, you don't have to do that search for parameters. You could determine the parameters on one instance and then use them on the next, and you'll have a good result if you already made it good on the first one. So this is kind of entertaining, and I mean, we can't kind of justify this. Well, I'll try to give a quick justification of this. Let me see what else it might. Well, anyway, very quickly, the way you might think of this, is that the cost function is a sum over clauses. And if you have a sum of m random numbers, and they're independent, and you look for the average, then by the law of large numbers, if they're independent, then and you sample from the distribution, then if you look at the sum of them, which is like the average, let's say the sum, you're going to get something of order m. Let's suppose every number is of order unity. I'm adding m numbers. I get something of order m when I sum them. But the standard deviation is of order square root of m by the law of large numbers. Doesn't matter, right? It just doesn't matter what the. You don't have to say anything else. All I have to do is say the terms are independent, and the law of large numbers tells you that the average will concentrate. Okay. And so, we could argue then that these terms are independent, and therefore we have kind of a justification for this. To test this, we measured correlation coefficients, and we could really argue, I thought nicely, that at 20 bits, we bet the correlation would be higher. We calculated them at 20 bits, the correlations between the different clauses, and they were very small. And then for this not to hold at higher bit number, then there would have to be a miracle that when you went to a bigger graph, distant things became more correlated. And that seems very unlikely. And one thing that frustrates me, especially if you read the blogs, is that people are very dismissive of a numerical simulation at no bit number. And they don't understand, frankly, because they're ignorant, that you can learn things which about high bit number if you read your data right. So for example, here, I would say that the fact that we could show very small correlations at 20 bits is very suggestive that at higher bit number it'll stay small, because how are they gonna start correlating when you make it big? And so you can conclude things from low bit number simulation. And I say this for some of you who read the blogs, and you should not take it so seriously. Okay, so anyway, this gives rise to another idea for how to run. Well, maybe I won't discuss this because it's just a way. I'm going to switch gears. We talked enough about this. I want to talk about something called the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model, where we have analyzed the QAOA. And let me tell you what this model is. This model is called the SK model, the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model. And it's the prototypical spin glass model. By that I mean, what do I mean by prototypical? It's an all-to-all graph, and there are couplings between every pair of bits in the graph. This is a classical problem. But the couplings are random, and they are chosen so that the coupling values, the expected value of the coupling, there's a random coupling, JAB. The average of the JAB is 0, and the variance of the JAB is 1. One way you can easily achieve this is to just pick the couplings to be plus or minus 1 with 50% probability. Another thing you could do is Gaussian with standard deviation 1. Variance 1, okay? This is the reason I'm going on about this. You have an all-to-all connected graph. You have random couplings. It's sort of the ultimate disordered all-to-all connected spin glass model. And what you can look at, though, it turns out that if you look for the string, so the model is fixed. The J's are fixed. But now, given the J's, I want to find the string that maximizes the cost function, okay? This is a classical problem. I have a fixed set of couplings. I want to find the string Z that maximizes the couplings. Well, you can argue without much work that, you know, this is an extensive quantity. See, you know, the energy or the cost of this thing, it's proportional to the number of bits. So if I want to take a big n goes to infinity limit, so I'm going to divide it by n. So Cj of z over n is something which is not growing with n, because it's the cost per bit, not the total cost. And if you average that over j and take the limit as n goes to infinity, you get a number, which is 0.763. And that number was calculated by Parisi, and he won the Nobel Prize 2 years ago for this calculation. This was the prototypical spin glass model, and Parisi calculated it. The reason that it was an achievement is because his methodology used what looked like voodoo. It was very hard for anyone to follow it. And he got this answer, and he invented a whole field called replica symmetry breaking studies of spin glasses, and then a bunch of mathematicians, French and I think Eastern European, proved that what Parisi did was correct. So this is sort of an important problem in the world of spin glasses, but Parisi proved what the highest energy is, or the lowest energy if you put a minus sign. But this doesn't say anything about finding a string that comes close to that, okay? This doesn't say anything about that. It just says what it is. But now I'm going to be interested in running the quantum algorithm in an attempt to find a string that does a good job. So we're just going to apply the QAO8 to this. And here at p equals 1 is the QAOA. And I'm looking at the expected value of the cost function. I really should put a J on that. Sometimes I put a J on the cost function, and sometimes I don't. But the cost function there really does depend on J. It depends on the coupling. And I insert complete sets. I'm just giving you a flavor for how you do the calculation. You insert complete sets. And you write the thing in terms of numbers, which are matrix elements. And the cost function is that, 1 over square root of n, the sum on a less than b of j of b. But note that if you take the expected value of a Gaussian, let's say, random variable j of e to the I phi j, that goes like 1 minus phi squared over 2 plus dot, dot, dot. That's just doing a Gaussian integral. Or alternatively, another way to see it is just let j be plus or minus 1, and that's a cosine, which whose Taylor expansion is that. So, you know, you can take the expected value of, let's say, Gaussians or from the other distribution of these things. So if we turn the crank on this, we were able to, upstairs, you see we have these j's, which come from the instance, and downstairs we have the cost function, but using the formula from the previous page, you can just turn the crank. And we were able to prove, as n goes to infinity, that we get 2 sine 2 beta cosine 2 beta gamma e to the minus 2 gamma squared for this, for the answer. That's the QAOA's performance. And at beta equals pi over 8 and gamma equals a half, we optimize and we get 1 over 2 root e, which is 0.303. So what the achievement here was, we managed to analyze the performance of an algorithm on all random instances of a problem in the n goes to infinity limit. Now, remember that the Parisi value is 0.76. Okay, so now, we did more than that, though. We were able, actually, to, for any p, derive an iterative procedure to evaluate that quantity, the expected value over j of the QAOA at parameters gamma and beta at any p as n goes to infinity. We got an iterative procedure to do that. So if I give you gamma and beta, you can go to my laptop, and it will output the expected value of the cost function in the n goes to infinity limit. Now, that iterative procedure, though, takes 4 to the p. So it's very expensive, numerically, to evaluate this. But I've already taken n to infinity, and I'm just telling you how hard it is to evaluate it for as the depth increases. And let's call this quantity Vp of the Sherrington-Kramatchik model of gamma beta. This I did with Sam and Jeffrey and Leo Zhao, who's now a postdoc at Caltech. Okay, so, but let's see how well the QAOA is doing by looking at the data. So now, once I can evaluate this, I can optimize. And here's a picture of, as a function of 1 over p, of how the QAOA is doing. So there we start with p of 2, we start with p of 1 all the way to the right. And then we go to p of 2, 3, 4, et cetera. I think here we went as far as p of 17 by using very sophisticated Google computers and sophisticated ways to analyze this. We could go to p of 17. And so what you can ask whether we're headed to the Parisi value or not. I mean, it doesn't look bad. One thing is we pass 2 over pi. And the reason 2 over pi is significant is because 2 over pi is the best classical assumption-free algorithm for this problem. And we beat that. So, I'm interested in knowing how far this thing will go. One of my big interests now is trying to take this further, but it's pretty complicated. Now, I want to look at another problem, which is consider max cut on a large girth deregular graph, and let's apply QAOA. Now, a large girth graph means that it doesn't have any loops that in small distances. There are no triangles, no squares, no pentagons. Large girth means that there are no small loops. So if you look at a large girth deregular graph, the neighborhood of every edge is the tree that looks like that. Because every single large girth deregular graph is locally a tree. And as you increase the depth, the tree gets bigger. I don't see the loops. Now, if I evaluate the expected value of the QAOA cost function in the state gamma beta, and I divide by the number of edges, you see, the QAOA max cut formula, you see, in max cut on a large random graph, if it was a random graph, I didn't even say it was, but if it was a random graph, you'd expect the cut to be roughly a half, because the best cut, because if you put down a random string, you get a half. So the fact that the expected value of the QAOA cost function divided by the number of edges starts at a half, that sort of had to be. That's sort of this base point. But then I'm going to write it as a function of gamma and beta, which depends on d and root d. And then what we were able to show, which was sort of interesting, is that in the thing I called the SK cost function, the performance of the QAOA in the SK model equals the limit as d goes to infinity of this other quantity. And this is very surprising because we've averaged over instances on one side, and on the other side, we only have one graph. And we showed that these two are absolutely the same. And this is work done with Joao Basso, Kunal Mawaha, Benjamin Volonga, and Leo Zhao. And people were surprised by this, that we could show this connection. So, I mean, one thing I'm saying here is that there's sort of interesting math problems in this thing. I think they're interesting. Okay. So let me, we could also show concentration. But in other words, that for this SK model, that every instance is the same. In other words, the same parameters work on every instance. And once you pick a string, you're going to get a certain value of the cost function, and every string will have that value. So there's like a double concentration here over instances and over measurements. But let's not get into that. Okay? So what I really want to show is that for n goes to infinity, we hit the Parisi value. And I don't know how to do that. That would be interesting, because it would mean that the QAOA has an alternate way. The QAOA can be used as an alternate way of exploring the ultimate Parisi limit. Okay? And I want to apply these techniques to other problems where instances are drawn from a distribution. Okay, so let me tell you about another finding. So this is now, I'm going to talk about the QAOA gets stuck starting from a good classical string. And this is work with Maddie Kane, who's a graduate student at Harvard, me, Sam Gutman, my longtime collaborator, Daniel Renaud, and Eugene Tang, who are MIT postdocs. So in the usual QAOA, we start in the uniform superposition over all strings, which is the plus state. Now, if you do that, you start in the uniform superposition, then you're sort of starting in a kind of, you know, very mediocre place, because, you know, your typical string has just an average value of the cost function. But you might then think that a good idea is to not do that, but to start in a good string. So for example, you might run a classical algorithm, like simulated annealing, or Gomans-Williamson, or whatever, and start from a good place. Why start in the uniform superposition when you could start somewhere good? You don't have to start with mediocre, you can start good. And so sometimes, you know, people talk about it as warm starting. The reason I don't call it warm starting is because warm is very confusing if you're going uphill. Because, or in terms of temperature, you want a cold temperature to get a warm start. You know, it can become extremely confusing. You know, because in simulated annealing, I would want to, you know, I want to be cold to get a warm start. So that was driving me crazy. So we call them good strings. Okay, not warm. But sometimes people talk to this warm start. Okay, anyway. So what would you do then? Well, then what you would do is you would just start in the computational base state, which corresponds to that warm string, or to that good string, good. Okay, and then you would run the QAOA on that. And now look for good parameters. Why not? I mean, it can't do worse, you'd think, because, I mean, why shouldn't it just get better? Because you're already starting at some place where the cost function has a certain value, and now I'm variationally trying to go up. So then you try it numerically, and it's a dramatic failure. At low bit number simulation, we cannot find any improvement besides the initial cost function. So you go to your computer, this computer, and which, for example, generate a 16-bit three-regular graph. It has 24 edges, because a three-regular graph with 16 bits has 24 edges. So the average cut value is 12. So then I can just look at it, because this instance you just have on your computer, and you pick something, a W, where the cost function value is 15. Okay? And then I tell the computer, start hunting for good parameters. And it always just sets the parameters to zero. It doesn't ever improve. Sometimes it improves by maybe 0.2. But this is at any depth I can put on the computer. Depth 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, no improvement. So then you say, well, maybe you chose a crappy starting state. So I do it for all the states whose energy is 15. And we see no improvements. So this is very dramatic. Now, let me give you a kind of weak argument for why this might occur. Slight intuition. Let's look at max cut. And there the cost function is that. We've seen this before. And I want to look at the expected value. I have a unitary operator, which comes from the QAOA. And I want the expected value of the cost function for bits I and j in the state W. So suppose U is 1. 1, that means I haven't done anything. Then The expected value is 1 if wi is not equal to wj, because it's max cut. You're happy when they disagree. And it's 0 if it's wi equals wj. Now, suppose if it's not 1, you get 1 minus epsilon if wi is not equal to wj, and delta if wi equals wj. So in other words, the good ones get a little worse, and the bad ones get a little better. But suppose that the amount that you improve is the amount that you degrade, and that's what's epsilon equals delta for all the clauses. Then you can see that in a good string, you're going to lose, because there are more satisfied edges than unsatisfied. So you have more things which are getting worse than getting better. So if the degradation is always roughly the same as the improvement, there's no, you're going to lose. Does that make sense? So there's a net loss. Now there's a case where we can prove this happens, and that's that I take a decoupled graph. So now I'm going to do max cut, but my graph is just a sequence of disconnected edges. It's a very easy problem. But in this case, because it's so simple that I just have disconnected edges, I can prove that epsilon equals delta for any edge. I can prove that if the degradation is equal to the improvement. In other words, if I started with the if you just have an edge, you have two qubits, there are 4 states. It's a very simple problem, and I can just prove this. But I can prove it at any depth. Actually, you just can. So at any depth, we can prove that the decoupled problem will fail. And that's already pretty discouraging for the warm start, because you'd think that if you have a stupid problem like a decoupled problem, that you should be able to maybe make improvement. And this shows it fails. But let me just contrast that with the P equals 1 QOOA starting in the uniform superposition. Then it works perfectly. You get the cut. Not only that, but if I could even make it harder, I could tell you that each clause is either wants the qubits to agree or they want them to disagree. Each clause can be different. Still, the P equals 1 QAOA gets it at P equals 1, gets a perfect solution. So there's a huge difference between the QAOA starting in the uniform superposition and what you get with that. So we also have beautiful thermal arguments for the more general case. But I think this is very fascinating. And the reason I'm interested in this is because we have to contrast this, where you warm start and you don't go anywhere, with starting in the uniform superposition, where we've never seen any impediment to improvement as you increase the depth. So there's something going on here which I think is worth understanding. I think it, but the referees of QIP 202 theory didn't think it, so this paper got rejected, but that's okay. Okay, so I would like to come to my conclusion. The conclusion is the QAOA is an easy to implement all-purpose optimizer. We have worst-case performance guarantees. Performance can only increase with depth. We can analyze random instances in the infinite size limit. There's not a hint of any obstacle to performance. I mean, what I mean is there are no numerical, no one's ever seen anything, you know, all the papers on the web, things just get better. So numerics are uniformly encouraging. This does not mean that the algorithm is going to work. It doesn't. I'm just telling you the facts. But I think we need to learn more. And the reason I particularly like this thing is because it's a playground that you can work in, right? You can analyze the performance of the algorithm. And you can't say that about many other heuristics. You know, here we have techniques for analysis. And that's why I like it. And that is the end of my talk. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you for that great talk. Any questions? Yep.
I have two questions. First is, why QAOA is suitable for disk devices?
I'm so sorry, I can't hear you.
Why QAOA is suitable for running disk devices?
Why is it good for NISC?
Yes.
Yeah, it is, because people do look at it for NISC devices. The reason is because you have good results at very shallow depth, and Google has run the QAOA on NISC devices. IonQ has run the QAOA. Now, what you typically find, though, is this. You see, if you have optimal parameters at any depth, you know, so if I start with the lowest depth, I get a certain expected value of the cost function. Then I go to the next depth, it could get better. The next step, better, 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 better. But if you look at the data, it doesn't do that. It goes up and then it starts to go down. That's because as the circuit gets deeper, there are more, the error propagates worse. You have more error from the deeper circuit. So at a P of 2 or 3, the error overtakes the improvement on today's devices. So we haven't really analyzed the QAOA on this devices. It has been studied, but it goes up and down. Does that make sense?
My second question is there any preferable quantum computing platform to?
I don't know. The question was there a preferable computing platform? I don't know. No, I don't think so. I mean, I'm happy that they ran it on IonQ. They ran it on, I think on IBM they've run it, and at Google. Question? Sure.
So you mentioned that.
Can you speak up or make it louder?
Yeah. You mentioned that you didn't get any improvement from a warm start or like a good string. Have you tried a cold start or
yes.
a bad string?
Yeah. Okay, I could talk about cold starts, yes. You see, yes, I can tell you what happens then. You see, if you're in any string, okay, and I don't call the cost function, and I rotate by, I guess, pi over 4, then every string becomes a superposition of 0 and 1 with different phases depending on where you started. So if I just act with e to the minus I beta equals pi over 4x on any string, what I do is I end up in a uniform superposition over all possibilities but with funky phases. Okay, they have crazy phases. But the expected value of that is the average. So if you start bad, you can go to mediocre. But by a simple way of doing it, bad can go to mediocre, it can go to 12. So in my example before, if I started at a cut value of 9, I could rotate and go to a cut value of 12, and my computer will do that. But if I start at 15, it can only go down. So yeah, bad can go to mediocre. But another thing that's interesting is like, if I start at 12, a string at 12, it doesn't move. Only below you can go to 12. Yeah, that's a good question.
Thanks again for the talk. A couple of questions, maybe first to follow on to Vincent's question. In the graph you showed going up to peak 17, I think it was, you didn't really see that decrease in accuracy that you were
talking about. No. Okay, hold on. So then I was not 100% clear. Let me go back to that and discuss it. Yeah, no, this is not something that was run on a hardware. This is our analysis of the performance of the QAOA on using a classical computer. And when I said a Google computer, I meant a big, ordinary Google computer with zillions of nodes, which was churning and polluting the air in order to get those numbers. So this is a classical computation of the performance of the QAOA. So this was what you would get on an ideal computer. Does that make sense? Yeah. This is not, when I said on Google, I meant using fancy Google regular computers, not the Google hardware.
And this algorithm, just like others, would, like, you have seen that decrease.
I'm sorry?
You have seen that decrease.
On hardware?
Yeah.
We ran the SK model as well. Yeah, everything starts to decrease because of the noise. I mean, till quantum computers are error corrected, as you go, you see, the nice thing about the QAOA is it can run on this device with the algorithm. But as the depth increases, the noise will kill you.
And then just a second question.
Yeah.
Let's say this problem, we ran it on a computer, got a great value. Someone outside the field, how hard is it then to adapt that to the world optimization problem?
Oh, I don't know. Okay, you're asking, like, how does the SK model map?
How difficult is that map?
Well, problem? Yeah, I don't. Well, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how, you know, could you map the traveling salesman problem into the SK model, for example? I don't know. And it's also, these are random instances. And if you were to do something like take the traveling salesman and you had an instance of the traveling salesman problem and you mapped it into the SK model, it's not clear that it would fit what I call a typical instance where every coupling is chosen with 50-50 probability. I don't know what it would look like. So I don't know how to, these are typical instances. These are not worst case. This is typical. I don't know why I put down typical in the beginning. Typical is interesting, yeah. But these are not worst case. These are typical. And, you know, it's very complicated. Like, if you have an algorithm, I mean, if you have a reduction, meaning a way to go from one problem to another, and the problem that you can solve typical cases quite well with one algorithm, it's not clear that when you take a worst case example from another algorithm, from another problem, that's going to map well into what you call the typical ones. Yeah, I don't know how those things line up. That's pretty complicated. Yeah. I mean, if we could prove that we go to the Parisi value, again, I don't think it would be algorithmically significant, but it would mean that we had a different way of approaching the whole Parisi formalism, so it would be very interesting theoretically. I mean, I would be very happy if I could show that after n goes to infinity and you take p to infinity, you get to the Parisi value, but I'm slightly more interested in the question of what would we learn from that. I mean, it would be a different way of doing it, because there's no replica symmetry breaking here. There's no voodoo. It's just crank turning, very straightforward crank turning. And so I think that would be pretty interesting. But I think if we could show that any problem, we temporarily showed for E3-Lin2 that we beat the best classical algorithm. That didn't last. But I think if we could prove that we could outperform a classical algorithm for something, it would just generate hope that the QAOA might be good for something. More questions, David?
Just wondering, I mean, you said that this algorithm beats the best classical algorithm with no assumption.
That's correct.
So why is it then that you say that
it's not? Well, okay, so on this, for this problem, there is an algorithm due to Montanari, which is his algorithm, which just came out 2 or 3 years ago, is a classical algorithm that will produce a string between 1 and 1 minus epsilon times the Parisi value, but the computational cost of running the algorithm goes like 1 over epsilon squared. So if you say, I want, you know, to be within one part in 1,000 of Parisi, well, if you run it 1,000,000 times, his algorithm, the scaling and the size is very good.
And that algorithm has some assumption.
That algorithm has an assumption, but the assumption is widely believed to be true. Okay, so you know, his algorithm is based on an assumption which is widely believed to be true. So I don't know how you, you know, push that. You know, I don't know what to say about that. Recently, Scott was blogging about the QAOA, and he was, you know, said some things about it, and he did not mention the fact that we beat the 2 over pi, and I asked him why, and he said because of Montanari's argument, he didn't care. Algorithm, he didn't care. So, I don't know. I don't know what to say, you know? I mean, it's a very strange world because, you know, there's a currency out there which is, you must beat the best classical algorithm or I don't care. And then if you do beat the best classical algorithm, they say, well, I still don't care.
Last question.
Thank you for the nice talk. So, like, another question about quantum advantage. My understanding of how, say, Shor's algorithm is so powerful is that, like, factoring belongs to this subset of problems that feel natural.
That what?
That, like, feel natural to a quantum computer. Sort of, like, sees in subgroups.
They feel that. You think factoring feels natural?
No, like, I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, there's not a ton of algorithms that have quantum advantage, but the one that we, like, or one that we rep, it seems to have, belongs to this group of problems that we've characterized pretty well now, like, in abelian subgroup problems. And these are just, like, nice to solve on a quantum computer in a way that looks hard to a classical computer.
Well... Okay.
Yeah, I'm just prefacing. I'm sorry. I'm maybe talking.
No, but let me say something about that.
Okay.
Look, if you, I mean, the whole, it's not that factoring is obviously conducive to put on a quantum computing. It's that Shor realized that factoring could be reduced to period finding.
Okay.
Once you realize that factoring is equivalent to period finding, then he had the inspiration from the Simons algorithm, and then you can imagine that a quantum computer could take a Fourier transform. So I think that was the key thing is factoring, is that it's really period finding, and a quantum computer is good at that. But if I just told you a bunch about prime numbers, you would feel pretty confused, I think. I mean, that was the brilliant insight. Was that, well, he wasn't the first person to know that you could, that factoring was equivalent to period finding, but he knew it, you know, because that's the kind of thing he knows.
Okay, cool, thank you. Yeah, so that's sort of what I'm asking then, is like, is there progress towards seeing, like, an insight about what kinds of cost functions?
Well, actually, I have almost no insight, you know. I mean, I should say another thing about the QAOA is that at the shallowest depth, which is P equals 1, it has quantum supremacy, which means that in worst case, you cannot sample from the output distribution of the QAOA. You can't produce samples with the same probability distribution. Now, that's with a very stringent requirement of accuracy. But with your super stringent requirement of accuracy, the QAOA has quantum supremacy at its shallowest depth. Now, that suggests to me that it's not a classical algorithm, because I think if it was classical, you couldn't do that. So there is supremacy, but if you're asking me for insight, I don't have insight. I don't, or intuition. I tend to not have that. I just calculate. I calculate now, think later.
All right. Well, on those final words, calculate now, think later. Let's thank Professor Fari one more time for a wonderful talk.